I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia is experiencing a worrisome increase in gun violence. So far this year, there have been 125 victims of homicide, most of them young black men. That's a 29% increase over this time last year, according to the police department. The city has also been dealing with the pandemic, using interventions to prevent and treat the spread of the deadly virus. What if we treated gun violence the way we are working to mitigate the spread of coronavirus using a public health approach? That would mean looking at root causes, identifying risk factors, instituting prevention and intervention policies, treating the traumas associated with systemic violence, and improving the environments where people live so they feel safe and healthy. That's what our guests are doing, and let me introduce them to you. Dr. Ruth Abaya is a pediatric ER physician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She manages the injury prevention program at the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, which just launched the injury prevention dashboard. Dr. Abaya, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And I should add, she is joining us by Skype. Also with us is Tyreek Glasgow. He's founder and executive director of the Young Chances Foundation, which is in South Philadelphia, that provides programs and resources for the community. Tyreek Glasgow, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Nice to have me here.
Nice to have you with us. And our third guest is Dr. Gina South. She's an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine and faculty director of the Urban Health Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. South, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, I want to make sure that you can join our conversation. We've got a lot to cover. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You know, in preparation for this show today, I was thinking about the couple of mass shootings that we've had in the last couple of weeks. They have been big news, and even if nothing will be done in response to those, there are calls for background checks and banning assault rifles and red flag laws and mental health interventions. Philadelphia's gun crisis is equally as worrisome. We're seeing it in other cities as well. And I wonder whether, Dr. South, we are just getting used to gun violence in cities and it just doesn't get the same kind of outcry or even coverage that mass shootings get. What do you think?
Absolutely, Marty. The reality is that for some people in Philadelphia and in some neighborhoods in Philadelphia, gun violence is a daily part of their life. And so it does not have the perhaps shock of when we have a mass shooting in a place that we don't normally expect. But it is has every much the same level of consequences for the people that are experiencing that daily barrage of violence.
And for you, Tyreek Glasgow, you work and live in South Philadelphia. Speak to that, if you could, about the impact of violence on the community where you live and work.
The impact on the violence for us, and this is what we're talking about, is every day. And the coverage that comes down in our community is systematic. It portrays the violence that goes on every day, but not the good things. We see the violence that goes on every day in our community, but we would like the highlights that happens also.
Sure. And when you say every day, you mean every day?
Every day, when you walk outside, from the teddy bears being on the poles, the paraphernalia from the drugs and spent shell casings and graffiti on walls and trash up and down the street. These are the things that we see every day, but we're trying to change those perceptions that are highlighted on the news every day from the violence that we see in our communities.
Absolutely, and that's why you're here, and I do want to get to that. Let me get to you, Dr. Abaya. Why are we seeing such a dramatic increase in gun violence in Philadelphia, 29% compared to this literal day from last year?
It's a great question, Marty. I think that there are multiple causes, and that's part of why gun violence can feel like such an entrenched issue, even though there are absolutely things that we can do to mitigate its effects. So I think that there's definitely good evidence that the challenges that COVID-19 brought to our communities have contributed. I think COVID-19 didn't necessarily create a problem, but it unearthed a number of problems, specifically some of the systemic and chronic disadvantages that certain communities felt. And I think that made an environment that was just made it easy to foster violence in that environment. In addition, I think that there has been a proliferation of guns on the street. I think that we know for a fact that throughout the country, and specifically in Pennsylvania, gun sales went up significantly in the early portion of the pandemic. So we expected, and I think we've started to see those guns show up on Philadelphia streets. At the end of the day, the ubiquity and just the overwhelming presence of firearms on our streets can't help but play a role. But you mentioned upstream factors in your introduction, and I think that really needs to be emphasized. And so at the end of the day, gun violence thrives, and all chronic diseases thrive in environments where people are poor and disadvantaged and have low educational opportunities, have low employment opportunities. We didn't ever kind of chronically fix those problems. And so the pandemic and other factors have allowed them to continue to thrive, and gun violence really does well in those environments. And so we need to continue to speak to those issues as well.
Dr. South, if I can go back to you, and we're trying to frame this problem, this crisis, frankly, in Philadelphia as a public health crisis. What kind of language, how do we reframe it so that we can approach it from that specific angle?
So a public health approach to violence is one that focuses on the whole population, on neighborhoods and communities, rather than just any single individual. A public health approach focuses on prevention and tries to get at some of those root causes that Ruth alluded to. Because if you do not address the root causes, nothing is going to change. And in fact, what COVID did was worsen those root causes, allowing gun violence to proliferate. And so we need to address those root causes. The other thing is, you know, a public health approach relies on data. We use data to drive decisions about where we spend money and where we invest resources. And when you think about some of those root causes that are really the result of concentrated disadvantage in segregated Black neighborhoods, which is the result of policies, which we can get into.
Sure.
But when you focus, when you think about that concentrated disadvantage, it's going to require concentrated investment to overcome those root causes.
Tariq, let me go back to you, and even going back to the community where you live and work, and I'm thinking about the pandemic, but also if we're focusing on young people, on adolescents and young adults, many of them cut off from either work or school or recreation centers. How much do you think just not being connected to that outside world has contributed to the problem of gun violence in Philadelphia?
I'm glad you said outside world, because that's actually is a segue to what the previous talk was speaking about with the policy and the leadership that to approach gun violence as a public health issue. And it's a head-to-toe approach. And when you have those leadership who don't address it in that way, you see the effect. In 2018, Councilman Johnson had submitted a bill, and the mayor had declared gun violence as a gun violence issue. So the thing will be is looking in the mirror as a community and saying how those resources now address our community that way. And as us as community organizations is finding the funding, finding the prevention tactics to help. We have health experts on there, but they're never at the table. As leaders, the doctors are never there to talk about the prevention, the intervention that happens on the scale that needs to be addressed in leadership roles. So I'm glad that this conversation is happening, and maybe our senior leaders can take this approach and have them at the table, because their input is definitely valued and needed to move the needle.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Tariq, let me ask you a couple of personal questions, because you come to this from your own unique perspective. I don't know, 15 years or so ago, you were shot something like 11 times. You have served time in prison. Can you speak a little bit about your younger self and what was going on with you?
I was born and raised in South Philadelphia. First and foremost, you know, I'm raised by my mother and grandma who instilled in me discipline. So I don't want to negate from the fact that I come from a strong background of women who raised me to do right. You know, it was my own will to go the fast way. And the fast way is what we see as what we talk about is every day in our community as trying to get over, trying to get over on a system that we don't feel portrays us in a positive way. I was shot 11 times on my head, back, leg, and arms. Wow. In the Grace Ferry neighborhood, but it's also the neighborhood that took care of me. This is also the neighborhood that when we don't have the recreation facilities, that when we don't have the proper schooling, there was the aunts and uncles who made sure that, you know, us, we are taken care of. I was shot and I went to jail because of consistent bad mistakes. And that goes to the programming. That goes to some having some structure in the communities that assist single families, assist the broken homes that institutionalize programs and systems have affected our families.
And picking up on what our other two guests were saying as well, and even just focusing just for a moment on guns, which is obviously a serious crime if we're talking about gun violence, just how easy, Tariq, is it to get a gun in Philadelphia?
It's easier now because of these ghost guns. I know that what you see on social media and in the news, they just see the death. But the way that these young people are getting the guns from out in the counties and the different parts of the state is really new to the people who are elected and the people on the street, so to say. And it's not to condone any of the violence that's going on, but this is a new beast out here. And we're trying to treat this with the same mechanisms that we were taking care of the last system. This generation is more tech savvy, is more, they will travel. They will do the things that is not tractable, so to say, like the CSIs. There is no serial numbers on these guns. So they are capable of using these things and throwing them away, so to say. It's easier to get a gun than it is to get a license in the city of Philadelphia. And that's to work, to Uber, to do the things that you see people do every day. It's harder to get that experience than it is to get a gun in the city of Philadelphia.
That's very disturbing. Dr. Abaya, we're almost up at a break here, and I want to pick up on what Tariq was just saying there. But is there a public health approach to preventing the spread of these deadly guns?
So I do think that there's a way to take, as Dr. South was referencing, kind of a more population view to how guns are handled. So rather than thinking about how individuals carry and interact with guns, how are they proliferating in our community in the first place? Mm-hmm. And what can we do from a policy standpoint to address those trends? So I definitely think that policy is an important part of our responsibility in addressing this problem. And we can't just look at local policy where, unfortunately, in many ways, our hands are tied. We have to look at statewide and even federal policy to think about how those rules, those structures are influencing how guns ultimately hit Philadelphia streets.
And I want to pick up on that after this very short break. We are talking about a public health approach to the problem of gun violence in Philadelphia. That's Dr. Ruth Abaya. Also with us, Dr. Gina South and Tariq Glasgow. And you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're looking at gun violence as a public health crisis. And our guests are Dr. Ruth Abaya. She's a pediatric emergency room physician. Yes, emergency room physician. Sorry about that at CHOP. She manages the new injury prevention program for the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. They have a new dashboard. Tariq Glasgow is a gun violence survivor and founder and executive director of the Young Chances Foundation in South Philadelphia. And Dr. Gina South is faculty director of the Urban Health Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Bay, if I can go back to you and picking up on what something Dr. South was saying about the importance of data, and I want to talk about this dashboard and what you were specifically looking at as a way to understand, I guess, the risks for gun violence, either to be a perpetrator, to put if I can put it that way, or to be a victim of.
Yeah, so as far as the purpose of the dashboard, the goal was to try to kind of centralize data sources for this public health issue. It's currently in phase one. And so what we did is we selected a short list of indicators to focus our initial efforts on. And just to provide an overview of this particular public health problem and some of the upstream drivers of this problem, to communicate why we thought it was important. We also talk about some of the downstream costs. So the most important costs are definitely the human costs, and that can't be something we lose sight of. Sure. But we also talk about emergency room visits, which was extremely relevant in 2020 when emergency rooms were tasked with dealing with COVID-19. We actually do have some data about some of the financial costs. So we can look at the full scope of gun violence and its full effect on our community. We definitely hope to expand what we can say about this public health crisis through the dashboard in future. And if we're all looking at the same data and drawing similar conclusions, hopefully that helps us all pull together.
And looking at risk factors, as I understand, it looks at poverty, education level, employment status, correct? Dr. Abaya?
Hi, sorry about that. Precisely. Yeah, so those things, and then also one other factor, something called opportunity youth. We look at opportunity youth just from ages 16 to 19, that is defined as people who are neither in school nor employed, who we recognize it being at particular risk.
And to you, Dr. South, how significant is it to bear down on these particular factors?
It's very important, getting back to thinking about the root causes of gun violence, and particularly, gun violence that occurs in segregated Black neighborhoods. Racial residential segregation is important because it patterns access to resources and opportunities. And that includes access to schools, access to proper food, access to nature, access to jobs and the preparation needed for jobs. And so looking at those indicators, especially when you think about, youth who are not in school but also not employed, that is incredibly important.
And how important is it to understand the impact of, of redlining and divestment and banking and real estate policies that have, in a sense, created some of these segregated neighborhoods in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I wouldn't say in a sense. I would say they absolutely have created these neighborhoods. And so it is important for people to realize that segregation, which is the hallmark of American neighborhoods, is not an accident. It is the result of historical and present day policies that determine who gets to live where and what resources go into those neighborhoods. And so if you think about, Philadelphia neighborhoods over the last 50 years, the result of disinvestment and not having the capital to invest in the physical infrastructure of neighborhoods is deterioration. And that's what Tyreek was talking about when you think about trash and graffiti, vacant lots, abandoned, crumbling housing. That's all the result of not having the resources to invest in neighborhoods. And we know that all of that is associated with gun violence.
And affects just people's quality of life, Dr. South.
Absolutely. So I did a qualitative study, one of my first studies.
I think we have lost Dr. South. Let's see if we can get her back. We might need to put her on a phone. But let me pick up with you, Tyreek, talking about what both Dr. Abaya and Dr. South were talking about, this about the importance of quality of life in neighborhoods, the condition of buildings, the open trash, the open lots. Help us understand what you see happening in your neighborhood.
So in this respect, it's twofold. As a community representative for Young Chances, we try to address it in the community so our community don't see it. But we know this is institutionalized racism. When you have programs in A1 rec centers that don't fund conflict resolution, doesn't have proper ventilation before the pandemic. And let's be clear that the pandemic is something that politics and what the news media use today. There has been a gun spike in our city for the last 10 to 15 years. There has been gentrification going on for the last 20 years. The things that go on in our community has not happened since March 13th of last year or since the pandemic started. There's rec centers that haven't had working water fountains. Now, working water fountains in the same area where you're asking kids to play healthy. And this is where the doctors are not at the tables because they're asking for funding to community groups, for gun violence prevention. This is head-to-toe approach. You can't address the body if you're not really having the people there to take care of them. The doctors, they're the number one people who can tell you how to fix your problem. COVID has gave us a blueprint of how to address gun violence. They have taken the vaccine and they have shut our whole country down. Let's take, for example, if they said, you know what, in the 19145 area, Tyreek, we're going to shut this whole system down from 25th Street to 33rd Street, from Snyder Avenue to Washington Avenue. And we're going to make sure that there's working streetlights. We're going to clean alleyways. We're going to properly fund the schools. We're going to put green grass in the recreation centers. We're going to make sure that there's 3 to 4 pantries. We're going to make sure that the seniors have transportation. All of these things that we know as experts, not the people that you work and you get your vote for and all those things. You work with the people that's going to change, and you see what happens. They open and close our country 3 to 4 times to make sure that the economy can get back. Imagine if they close communities to make sure that families can get back.
That's a profound thing that you just said there. Let me give Dr. Ruth Abaya a chance to respond to that. And even going back to the dashboard, and I appreciate what you're going to find and what you're doing. At the same time, I feel like, don't we know what the problems are and what needs to be done? We just haven't done them yet.
It's an excellent question. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think that there are some narratives that we just get used to repeating, even in spite of the data. So for example, we very appropriately focus on the lives lost to gun violence, but there's an equal focus that needs to be made on the 4+ times number of people who are shot every year who survive, and just the physical and emotional sequelae of those, of what is happening to those individuals, to their families, and to their communities, how that reframes their perspectives on life, how it changes their opportunities, their employment and their education and their mental health. And so I think that looking at something that shows you how many people are affected by gun violence in addition to those who lose their lives, even though we know that that's true somewhere in our minds, sometimes that data gets lost. So I do think that the data does need to be repeated at times. But to your point, are there not things that we know work? The answer to that is yes. And so I think the other piece of a public health approach is identifying effective strategies, testing them, and so focusing on evaluation. And when you find something to be effective, scaling it. And so making sure that you have the appropriate investment and commitment to have programs that are known to be effective in all relevant parts of the city. I think that the investment piece is critical.
Well, yeah, and I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I'm picking up on something you said earlier about the fact that there's so many people who have survived gun violence. Focusing on them, this obviously the kind of trauma associated with being the victim of gun violence. By focusing on them and using a public health approach, how do we intervene? And because we know that violence can beget violence, how do we intervene there to sort of prevent the contagion of violence? And if I can toss that back to you, Dr. Abaya.
Absolutely. So we do have some good programs on the ground here in Philadelphia that address the immediate after effects of violence. And this ranges from people who do community violence reduction strategies on the street to people who do hospital-based violence intervention programs. And so these are programs that are specifically geared at people who have sustained trauma, both physical and emotional, from gun violence and are at risk for either retaliatory violence or chronic mental health issues and even just long-standing physical rehabilitation needs. And so if we can make sure that we enable those programs to do their work in every part of the city where they're needed, if we can continue to measure their outcomes and scale them to effect, I think we'll be taking a significant step.
Dr. Seth, let me go back to you. I'm glad you're back. And I want to pick up on the work that you have been doing, looking at sort of the quality of life, what the infrastructure in a community looks like, and how planting trees and creating mini parks, that can actually reduce the level of gun violence. Help us understand how that works.
Absolutely. We actually have a very high level of science and of evidence that shows that when you improve the physical environment of neighborhoods, that gun violence goes down. And I'll give you examples of that. But before I do, I just want to sort of piggyback off of your question to Ruth and saying that we do know what works. We know we have, there's a great report from the John Jay Research and Evaluation Center about 7 key evidence-based strategies to prevent violence that do not involve the police. And so we know what works, but the fact that we have not poured the amount of money that we need to into these programs across a variety of types of programs and both place-based and individual focus, and the fact that, you know, homicide continues to be the leading cause of death for Black boys and men age 1 to 44, to me, that is the biggest indicator that Black lives still do not matter as much as white ones in this country. And so let me answer your question though about place-based efforts, because this is one of those things. We, myself and my collaborators, Charlie Brannis, John McDonald, and others at Penn and Columbia, we have over the last 10 years produced a series of studies showing that greening vacant lots, planting trees, remediating abandoned houses, even structural repairs to homes that are lived in, that all of that is associated with reductions in crime. We've also even done a cost effectiveness study showing a return on investment for money spent investing in the physical infrastructure in neighborhoods that that saves money for society ultimately around gun violence.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking about money. It doesn't cost a lot of money to plant trees, does it, Dr. South?
Exactly. So when you think about something like greening vacant lots, which is an intervention that the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society has been doing for many years, that is funded by the City of Philadelphia and other funding sources, that basically takes, you know, the blighted lots that Tyreek was talking about and turns them into clean and green spaces, and including planting trees. When you do that, particularly in the poorest neighborhoods in Philadelphia, you see up to a 29% reduction in gun crime. And we showed that in a randomized controlled trial across the city of Philadelphia, which in science, that is the highest level of evidence. And so why are we not spending more money doing that in neighborhoods?
I'm going to let that question hang out. Tyreek, I know you want to respond. Go ahead.
I would just say true. They will never allow her to say this in public. This is what they frame focus deterrence. This is what they frame the gun violence intervention pieces on. They do it on the backs of Black Lives Matter, and they know this.
Hey, Tyreek, just one. Who's the thing that you're referring to?
The City of Philadelphia. Okay. When you look at the programs, you say why they're not funded. This is it. Don't point the finger at community groups to say we need your help. When you have data from Temple, UPenn, Drexel, all of the health experts. This is why they're never at the table. This is like when you're looking at something healthy and you don't want it because you don't know. You don't know how to eat healthy because all you're eating is Chinese food, this fast food, and you're wondering why diabetes and all this stuff is up until they bring some healthy stuff. And it's like, hey, I want smoothies. I want to eat drink infused water. Why they're not letting the doctors speak to our community and say, you know what? Their violence will stop if they stop walking past this alleyway that smells like urine, that has paraphernalia out of it, that it has a teddy bear on a pole all the time. That's gun violence intervention. And these are the line items they do not fund, that they fund the experts for it to get the data. And once they get the tools to get us out of poverty, to get us out of gun violence issues, to get us out of domestic violence, they shut the door on them.
You know what, Tony?
They don't allow them to talk.
Yeah, I hear you. But let me give Dr. Abaya back, because you are working with the city. Do you feel shut out?
Do I feel shut out from the city?
Yeah.
So my personal sense is that in the year plus that I've been working with the city, that the phrase public health approach has been rising as a topic of discussion, which I've been really gratified to see. I do think that in sometimes when we talk about gun violence prevention, we do act as if we need to find something brand new. And I definitely appreciate what everyone has been saying in the sense that there are effective programs. There are effective programs that are on the ground in Philadelphia right now, and there are effective programs that we have either tested or piloted in prior years. And so if we can scale them, which is why I keep mentioning scalability, I think that we have room to grow. And I think there's an appetite for that. Everyone is kind of maximally frustrated with the chronicity of this public health crisis at this point. And that gives us an opportunity to really finally make some moves.
Terry, let me put a question to you from Kalisha from Bristol. She says, can you talk about parental involvement? What role can parents play to get their kids off the streets and keep them away from trouble? I mean, we've done hours and hours of shows about that. But what are your thoughts, to Keisha?
The approach for parents is for looking in the mirror and addressing it, the mental and emotional health. A lot of times, family members, parents, they don't have the structure to be a parent. And that's really acknowledging the strengths that you have as a person. If you were raised in a single household, or if you were raised with not the structure to have your child go to school or to have some after school activities, it's not going to be instilled in you to pass it on to your child. So that's why the real focus on bringing parenting programs to the rec centers, faith-based organizations inside of hospitals, to make sure that these families have the resources and skills to become proper parents.
We're almost having a break, Tariq, but we're talking about a poor city, and the pandemic, of course, has had a really terrible impact on various neighborhoods in the city. What about, do people have food? What about food insecurity?
Yes, that's another big issue, and they know that even coming from the health break, the number one meal that you need to start your day off is breakfast. And in our community, you know, you have a truancy rates that are high to combat some of those things. I would think we'll have a pantry for breakfast that allows you an adequate, proper, healthy meal to start the day, and having them inside of recreation centers to enhance the services that's going on in those low-income communities.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about how to have a public health approach to the gun violence problem here in the city of Philadelphia. That's Tariq Glasgow. He's a gun violence survivor, founder and executive director of the Young Chances Foundation in South Philadelphia. Dr. Gina Sari, South Faculty Director of the Urban Health Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Ruth Abaya, pediatric ER physician, manages the new injury prevention program at the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. More after a short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about how to have a public health approach to the problem, the crisis, frankly, of gun violence in the city of Philadelphia. Dr. South, if I can go back to you, and I just want to pick up on the kind of trauma associated with violence, whether one is a victim of violence, whether, as Tariq was talking about, hearing the sort of almost everydayness of gun violence in so many neighborhoods in Philadelphia. I'm even thinking as ER doctors yourselves, the kind of trauma of dealing with people who have been gunshot victims. And trauma is often sort of unrecognized and often sort of untreated because we don't really understand the depths of what that can do to a person. Can you speak to that?
Sorry, that to me, I didn't hear the first part.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that was to you, Dr. Zell.
Oh, perfect.
I'm sorry. Long,
okay.
Long question, but go ahead.
Yeah. The trauma is real. Mm-hmm. You know, so two things. One, we
do not have a good phone. Yeah, we lost her. We're going to get her back on her phone. And let me put that to you, Dr. Abaya.
I really appreciate you bringing up trauma as a point of conversation. I think that we have to address kind of two types of trauma, kind of chronic trauma and more acute trauma. So one of the things that has come up repeatedly that's critical is the effects of systemic racism and the ways in which that traumatizes certain communities over time. And the trauma that people sustain by what they are forced to bear witness to, by what they don't gain access to, and what that does to someone's ability to thrive in community. And then there's the acute trauma of being a direct victim or witness of gun violence or having family members lost to gun violence, and what that does to your immediate physical and emotional health, and how that burden on your physical and emotional health manifests physically. So there's great data that suggests that if you have a lot of kind of chronic and enduring psychological stresses that affects your ability to fight off other types of chronic diseases over time. And so I think that the conversation about trauma needs to be amplified. We need to recognize its effects both before and after something like gun violence, and we need to normalize that conversation.
And Tyreek, let me put a question from one of our listeners talking about schools and the role that, that schools and education and frankly underperforming schools has on this issue of violence and even the kind of quality in day-to-day life and even the kind of trauma that Dr. Abaya was just talking about.
Yes, I'll break it down into two. So the underperforming thing, and go to the data, and this make no mistake, the Philadelphia school system as a whole needs to be revamped. But there are quality teachers, counselors, NTAs, parents who put that work in every day to make sure that the students, the kids, are not representative of the numbers out there. I will say that it needs to be an enhanced after school, some more critical thinking program, conflict resolution. Yes, the school district of Philadelphia has let the community of Philadelphia down. Let's be clear. But if they enhance and highlighted some of those hardworking schools that are doing it on no budget or on a shoestring staff, that volunteers come in and day out to make sure that things are going right. There is a safe corridor program in South Philadelphia with volunteers with crossing guards, parents, make sure that kids can walk to and from school without being shot. These are the things that are done every day in the school that people don't talk about in our community with the small organizations around those areas. The trauma, I would say, from being shot myself, I haven't got over it. I'm 37 now, and I was shot when I was 20. The effects that my mother and my sister and even community members still, you know, act, it still hurts. I still feel the pain. You know, I remember when my uncle was killed and hearing my grandma scream at 4 a.m. That hurts me. And those are the things that it never was addressed to me as a child, as a young black man, to get therapy, to understand counseling, to understand what the emotional and mental abuse is for myself. And these are the things that go into your relationship when you are trying to build a family, when you don't understand your emotional approach and your intelligence to how to communicate with your other half. And you use these same numbers in our community to dictate and stereotype us as a whole.
Mm. Tyreek, I'm just curious, as a 20-year-old, what would have helped you? What would have helped you deal with that trauma as a younger man?
Consistent guidance. And I mean guidance as in the family, as in our community. Ultimately, times it's a separation on how we're advertised and looked at as a man and as being black. Sometimes we point the finger and we don't know our own. A black man, I know that our women, our mothers, our grandmothers raised us, but there's no description of who we are, what we should be, who should we become. And we're fighting with that, and our ownership, and it's sad to say, is the violence, is the coming home from jail and just trying to make it. And that's the reality where people don't want to have a conversation of that man been hurt before he picked up the gun. That man was lost before he went to jail. And this is what needs to be addressed in the daycare centers and to this early childhood education. That the Dr. Abayos need to be down there talking to the parents and the mothers and the fathers to let them know that it's not your fault, that this is a generational problem. This is an institutional issue, that you don't have to point the finger at everything else. Let's look in the mirror and get over your mental health issues. Hmm. Let's address it and go from there.
Dr. Self, if I can go back to you, and thank you. I'm sorry we're having some connection problems with you, but I'm glad you're back. And I'm thinking
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, not your problem. It's just the world, you know, the technical world that we live in. But I'm thinking about Mayor Kenney's going to release the sort of new, hopefully improved roadmap to safer communities. But I know they have identified increasing the graduation rates and reducing truancy and more job opportunities for at-risk youth, public health infrastructure, greening lots, rehab, recreation centers, and on and on and on from there. I'm not minimizing that at all, but I'm trying to underscore the fact that none of that is easy. I mean, none of what we're talking about is, unless maybe planting trees is. But if we're talking about a public health approach, I don't want to minimize it, that somehow it's going to be easier than what we have been doing.
I'm
wrong. I don't know.
Well, you know, I honestly think that it's probably easier than we think it is, but it requires money. That is the key thing. I can't keep saying that over and over again. We can continue, if we don't fund things properly, it's not going to work. And then we will say it was too hard and make up a bunch of excuses. It requires money. The top line item in our budget in this city is the police department. And that is true for big cities across the country. So we need to shift our priorities of what we're funding to fund these prevention efforts. And if we fund them properly, that is the only way we can get over decades and decades and decades of disinvestment and lack of funding.
Let me go back to you, Dr. Abaya. My understanding from the stimulus package from President Biden, Philadelphia is going to get something like $1.4 billion. Now, we're a poor city. You know, the pandemic has really wreaked havoc on the budget in the city. But nonetheless, that's a lot of money. How should it be spent, do you think?
Yeah, so one of the things that's really encouraging about the not just the stimulus package, but I'm also looking down the street to the infrastructure package that that President Biden is floating, is that there's money specifically dedicated to community violence prevention, which is kind of a novel thing to have happen. And that amount was about $900 million and was increased to over $5 billion in response to an outcry from researchers and public health advocates from the Black and Brown community specifically around the country who recognize that it's just not enough. If you want to have systemic improvement, you have to have systemic investment. And so it's really encouraging to see that those amounts are coming down. As far as how it should be spent, this is where I think I would really love for us to follow the data. And so if we can demonstrate, and we already have demonstrated, that there are interventions such as what Gina and her group did, that shows that we can transform Philadelphia communities and the physical environment, and that can drive down shootings and have other downstream health benefits in addition to just driving down shootings. That needs to be said as well. Then let's invest in those in a sustained way and start to see that turn around. It's just really exciting to see an appetite for that emerging in local government all the way to the federal government and some real opportunity for investment.
Here's and a Marty, comment. Can I jump in and say one more thing? I think the other thing with increased investment and with the money that's going to be coming is accountability. Yes. There has to be accountability for the people who are in charge of where the money is being spent, both accountability up, but accountability to communities. And so community leaders like Tyreek should be at the table with the leaders of the city who are deciding how the money is going to be spent. There has to be transparency and accountability so that there's no questions about how the money is spent and making sure using data and the dashboard that the money is going towards evidence-based solutions.
I heard a yes from you, Tyreek.
Yeah, and I totally agree with what the doctors are saying. And when you talk about the police department being the number one funded thing, and there is opportunity for us as community leaders and representatives too. We're saying defund the police, not the internal defund it. I'll allocate it to the junior PDACs. I'll allocate it to the resource walks. I'll allocate it to the community advisory boards that allow trainings. Their power centers, increase those things. Increase information for when you show up to calls, that you have mental health experts, that you're hiring community liaisons to work closely with your police districts inside your police service areas, your pinpoint areas. If you're going to have the biggest budget, have the biggest impact, those are the things that you want to have. You have the biggest targeted community that you're going for that most likely to shoot or be shot. Go after the most funded agency also to show the most results. And I say that because we called on Commissioner Outlaw to come and do a job. And let's be fair, she hasn't had an opportunity. You know, one of the things that she did, she presented a plan. She presented a plate. And I'm not speaking up for the commissioner or on behalf of the police department, but she wasn't given an opportunity to apply her program, her approach, what she wanted to implement. And I'm only speaking because I know that as a Black woman who has two sons, she understands. And she may have a different approach to addressing it. And give her the opportunity. Give our leaders that's in position that runs the Special Committee on Gun Violence to allocate money to the communities and the grassroots organizations that are there, allowing these doctors to have a voice at the table in the communities down there. And I'll just end this too. When the police show up, they show up with the intent to serve. But if they really want to serve this, the ambulance should have resources in it. Just think about the vaccine for COVID. It resuscitating is giving us life and hope. what if the vehicle that showed up to a domestic or to a shooting or to someone that a community that lost life, and inside of that van, it was hope. It was life. You brought something back because that block was dead. And you said, you know what? Here you go.
Marty, what if I could say something?
Yeah, is this is Dr. Rabaya?
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make one comment about evidence. So in addition to actually funding evidence-based programs, scaling them, and sustaining them, I do want to mention that it's possible that we don't all know yet what the most effective programs are. Not all of the programs that are doing good work have the capacity, have had the ability to evaluate their outcomes. And there's been a lot of research and media attention on this recently, the fact that there may be some programs that we just haven't studied yet. So in addition to funding what we know works, we need to be open to the possibility that there are things that work that we need to study. It needs to go in both directions. And I just wanted to mention that.
Absolutely. Let me get Melissa joining us on line three to join our conversation. And Melissa, we are almost out of time, but I want to give you a chance to have your say on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, and thank morning. You all so much for having me. I just want to say, listening to your three guests, oh my God, all of the things that I've been thinking and saying, you guys are amazing. White supremacy is what this violence is rooted in. Look at the inception of our country. Look at the life of the Black American through history. If you can pinpoint one time that white America, who's been in control of the resources forever, has tried to save Black America. When Black people try to save themselves, you guys see it. History tells you that white mobs go in and destroy all of the leeway and the successes that Black people create for themselves with the resources, the inventors, the doctors, the researchers, you name it. And we look at today, right? We look at how white men make their money. They prefer to live outside in the collar counties and come into the city and get their salaries plus overtime. That is why we have the inflated police budget. Look at the towns around Pennsylvania. Our Black men and Black boys and women are extracted from Philadelphia, put out there in the small towns, and they are the economic engines that keep white men gainfully employed and take care of their families. But what?
Well, you know what? I got to jump in. And let me just give Dr. South just a quick response to our caller. Unfortunately, we're out of time. She put a lot of stuff out there. What do you think?
I have to agree with everything she said. I mean, it's going to be rough for some people to hear that message, and it may turn some people away, but it is the truth. And we as a country have to face that truth. That is what, after George Floyd was killed and we had a national uprising, that is the truth that we are trying to face. That is what people were out in the streets marching against. And so now we have to have that conversation. We have to have the hard conversations about the history of this country and acknowledging it and then doing the hard steps that it's going to take to rectify it.
And we're almost out of time here. Just a quick follow-up to you, Dr. South. I mean, do you feel like we're at a juncture, a real turning point here?
We may be. I hope that we are, but I think it remains to be seen yet what is going to happen. I mean, honestly, I think the energy from last summer is not the same. But I hope that the people on the ground who are doing this work day in and day out will continue to be supported, funded, to be able to really make those differences that we need to see.
Well, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we could go on. Dr. Gina South, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine, Faculty Director of the Urban Health Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Tyreek Glasgow, Founder, Executive Director of the Young Chances Foundation in South Philadelphia. Tyreek Glasgow, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Dr. Ruth Abaya, pediatric emergency room physician at CHOP. She manages the injury prevention program at the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, and they just launched the injury prevention dashboard. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.